House Committee on Education will come to order. Welcome to the committee meeting this afternoon. For colleagues and members of the audience, I want to walk you through a little bit what's happening today. We have a lot of balls in the air, a lot of people who are here interested in a number of things, so I'll give you a sense of where we are. The first thing we're going to do is the public hearing and work session on the Smart Reading Day resolution. We're then going to move into the hearings on 2508 and 2487. We do have two bills. Some of you have been religiously coming to this committee waiting for us to do the work sessions on House Bill 2062 and 2063. Colleagues, I am so pleased to report to you that we are ready to move House Bill 2062 and House Bill 2063. And Legislative Fiscal is going to help us do that, but they are working very hard to get that fiscal impact statement ready. It might be close to 2:30 before those are printed and available for us. And so when those get here, we are going to move these bills out of the committee. So we may pause the other public hearing to take care of this work session and then go back in. Are there any questions about that order from the panel here? No? Great. So thank you all in advance for your patience. I would also encourage you now to reach into your pockets or your purses or your backpacks and pull out your cell phone and turn it to silent, not just to vibrate. If it's on vibrate, it kind of messes up the recording system, and you may want to listen to this tape over and over and over again later, and your phone could interrupt the listening pleasure of others and those that are listening right now on the internet. So thank you very much, and I will open a public hearing on HJR 19. And Kevin, will you give us a brief background? Sorry about that. I should have looked over.
Oh, no, I'm sorry. Moving around, Madam Chair, members of the committee, this is House Joint Resolution 19. This joint resolution designates March 16, 2009 as Start Making a Reader Day or Smart Reading Day and commemorates the volunteers of the SMART program for their work that they've done ensuring that children today succeed as readers in the future. And that is our resolution.
Thank you. I think that they're coming from all directions. I believe that I'm being signaled that Representative Thatcher and Representative Comp would like to testify to us from down there, so please do.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. I am Kim Thatcher from, and members of the committees, of course. I am from Kaiser, represented from Kaiser, St. Paul, and Newburgh, and I thank you for letting me bring this resolution today. In fact, I think everybody's signed on to it, almost everybody. Everybody I've had a chance to talk to, anyway. And if I haven't had a chance to talk to you yet, please get signed on. Today we have with us the CEO for SMART. And if you don't know what that stands for, it means Start Making a Reader Today. But I want to give you a glimpse of why I got involved with SMART, which stands, stands for Start Making a Reader Today. When I was a kid, my parents made reading a big priority, and they read to me and had me read to them almost every day. I still love to curl up with a book whenever I get the chance, and as a mother of four, I tried to carry on that family tradition, and realizing kids all learn at their own pace, my youngest one needs a little help. And so 3 years ago, I got involved with SMART. There's a lot of kids out there that do need a little extra help. And I got started in elementary school in my neighborhood. And then I moved over, because the program shut down there, went over to Yoshikai Elementary. And what happens is each volunteer reads for a half an hour with a student, two students in a row for a total of an hour. I had the opportunity to read for 2 years in a row with a little boy named Alec. And he was really struggling, even with pronunciation of words and recognizing more than maybe just a handful of words. And eventually he started picking up a few words as we were going along. And I can't tell you how rewarding it was to see his face light up every time we got a chance to get together. And he would get into a story and couldn't wait to turn the page to find out what happened next before I finished reading the sentence. But SMART has been a great resource for local schools, and we certainly need more SMART, our volunteer programs like SMART, to help during tough budget times, but like many organizations in the community, SMART has also had to face big cuts. And they last year took a cut of $1 million, and that involved transitioning nearly 200 paid part-time coordinators to volunteer positions to sustain their operations. They changed paid people into volunteers. That was a big transition, and I know they've been able to serve many, many more kids because of that. And I just want to send a message. Everybody needs to get involved with SMART. It's great. I love it. It only takes an hour a week to volunteer for SMART, and it makes such a big difference in the lives of so many children. Colleagues, I also want to draw your attention to a small amendment to update the figures on the first whereas clause, line 2. And what we want to do is just basically turn a negative into a positive. Instead of mentioning the number of third graders who read below grade level, we will now mention how many third graders are at or above state standards. We want to encourage kids to read, and the only other change is that we add in a whereas after line 9, and talk about the importance of SMART and how it plays a role in increasing the literacy proficiency of our students. And with that, I'll turn it over to Mr. I'll let Representative Comp testify, and then we'll call up CEO Terry Shanley.
Thank you, Chair Gelser, members of the committee. My name is Betty Comp. I represent House District 22, and I come here on behalf of Start Making a Reader today. And the reason why I do that is really twofold, and that is SMART helps students begin to learn to read, and then beyond that helps them reach fluency at grade level. The amount of our third graders that are reading at grade level increases appreciably in Oregon almost every year through our assessments. We know that. With that, the foundation is that we have over 7,000 students served every year with Start Making a Reader today. We have 5,300 volunteers in our schools just on this endeavor all the time in our schools, and that collaboration, that mentoring with another adult, somebody else helping the teachers out, is really an incredible focus for our students in our schools. And I am going to be very brief because we do have a big agenda today, but the last thing that I would share is the number one, and we all know this, the number one reason why people are in prison is they are illiterate. They have struggled all their lives, and then it leads to a range of other behaviors that aren't positive. And SMART is one of the best single investments we can make in helping establish a high level of literacy in our state. So thank you, and we will let our next...
He just has a few words to say, if he could come up, the CEO of SMART.
Oh, yes, is that Terry Shanley?
Yes, Terry
Shanley. Yes, so Terry Shanley and Mike Dewey.
Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you both very much.
Come back up and join you on the dive.
Wonderful. Thank you both.
I was going to ask them to read a story to us, so that but you let them off.
I have to send you to the principal's office.
Okay.
Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Mike Dewey, on behalf of SMART. First of all, I want to thank the good Representative Thatcher and her staff for going through a monumental effort to get a lot of signatures and to think about the program and putting together this resolution. We hadn't thought of it, and it's a great idea, and we really appreciate it. And thank you, Representative Comp, also for speaking. We represent SMART. It's real nice to be able to be up here and talk about a program that is not controversial.
It's we appreciate that, too.
Notwithstanding that, as an aside, SMART does receive some dollars from the state, and we'll have that discussion down in Ways and Means. We recognize that times are tough. It's reflected in their budget, too, and the charitable giving that others are seeing in terms of the decline. But it's a tremendous program. We believe in it. And I want to introduce now Terry Shanley, who has a passion for this program, and he can talk a little bit about what the program is up to, what we're looking at. At the end of the day, what we will do is convince you that the multiplier effect by the volunteers is so substantial that you'll want to continue making a contribution. But that's not why we're here today. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, and I want to extend a personal and special thanks to Representative Thatcher and Representative Comp for your kind words. For the record, my name is Terry Shanley. I'm representing the nonprofit SMART, Start Making a Reader Today. My friends are quick to point out that when SMART is used with my in connection with my name, that it's a noun, not an adjective. I'll wait for that to sink in for just a second. Start Making a Reader Today was formed 17 years ago, 1992, because there was a direct relation between crime and literacy. Then Governor Goldschmidt and the Ada Wynn law firm teamed up to found it. And since that time, we've made some gradual improvements in reading competency, but we are still far behind what we all should believe should be the standard, and that is proficient readers. So it was started with the idea that the vision that every child in Oregon could read and would be empowered to succeed, making less drastic choices or urgent choices. And it's important, what we've done is we've partnered with schools, and kindergarten through third graders, where we have a volunteer come in and read an hour a week with that child for 28 weeks. It's one-on-one connectivity and a mentoring role to help them love to read. During the course of that time, those 28 weeks, they receive two books a month, or 14 books over the course of the school year from October to May, which is when we're in the schools. So they get to create their own libraries at home and extend the SMART reading experience. Representative Comp, last year we mobilized 10,300. We affected 10,300 children last year and mobilized 9,500 volunteers. Over the past 17 years, we do this in partnership with schools because we are support to them, obviously. But over the past 17 years, I think it's important that this committee know that there have been 1.5 million books given away to children, to those children that oftentimes don't have books in the home. And we have provided 2.4 million volunteer hours to the public schools. You can imagine over 17 years we have a lot of wonderful stories to tell, one of which that really defines the efficacy of the program is a young student named Alan. 11 years ago in 1998, he was a second grader and scored in the bottom 10% of reading proficiency in his class. His parents said that they read to him at home, but when he went to school, he struggled. But on the days that he was going to meet with his SMART reader, it was easier to get him out of bed. Alan today is a candidate for a finalist, actually, for the National Merit Scholarship. On his PSATs, as a junior in high school, he scored in the top 1% in the country. His mother attributes that success, of course, to his teachers and to the schools, but said they wouldn't have been as likely had it not been for SMART. So those are the stories that we get to tell and get to see every single day. We get to help put children on the right path so they make less desperate decisions in their lives. We're honored to be part of the solution. And I say part of the solution for Oregon literacy. And thank you very much for the sponsorship of the bill. And I hope to see you all on the 16th, where we will read the award winner for this year. Because the kids get to vote participate in the democratic process by voting for their favorite book. And we announce that every single year. So that will be done on the steps here of the Capitol on the 16th. So thank you.
Thank you very much. And colleagues, the reason that we scheduled this bill for today was so that we can get it in the queue so that we can hear this bill, this resolution, in the House chamber on the 16th. And with that, I'm going to close the public hearing. Thank you so much for coming and for all of the work that you do for our children. And I'm going to open a work session on HJR 19.
Madam Chair. I move to adopt the -1 amendment to HJR 19, dated 2/27/09.
Representative Dimbro moves to adopt the -1 amendment, dated 2/27/09. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, is there any objection? Seeing none, so ordered. Is there another motion?
Yes, Madam Chair. I move HJR 19 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Dimbrough moves HJR 19 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, would you please call the roll, Debbie?
Representative Parker?
Yes.
Representative Huffman?
Aye.
Representative Comp?
Aye.
Representative Roland?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Representative Van Orman?
Aye.
Vice Chair Dimbrough?
Aye.
Vice Chair Springer?
Aye.
And Chair Gelzer?
Aye. Receiving the majority of votes, the motion...
Madam Chair,
yes.
I would also like to vote.
She missed Mauer.
Oh. Yeah. He adopted Mauer while you were out of the room.
Representative Mauer.
Aye.
Thank you.
Receiving the required number of votes, including Representative Mauer's vote, the motion passes. Representative Kopp and Representative Thatcher, thank you so much for bringing this to us. And Representative Thatcher, will you carry the bill for us, please?
Okay.
Thank you. And I'm going to close the work session on HJR 19. And open, is Representative Klim back there somewhere? All right. In that case, I'm going to open the public hearing on House Bill 2508. If Representative Klim comes in, who I know wants to testify on House Bill 2487, I may briefly suspend the public hearing so that we can get his testimony and move back. Kevin, can you give us a brief overview of the House Bill 2508?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, HB 2508 is before you, requires the State Institution of Higher Learning to waive student fees for a teacher or employee of the institution if the teacher or employee is attending the institution for purposes of receiving a graduate degree and is receiving a tuition remission from the institution.
Thank you. Our first panel is Rob Wagner, Rob Hess, and Glenn Morris.
Madam Chair, for the record, Rob Wagner, representing the American Federation of Teachers, Oregon. I should say, Madam Chair, members of the committee, and Representative Mauer. And, representing the American Federation of Teachers, Oregon, our members include pre-K through post-secondary education employees in both the public and private sector, as well as healthcare professionals. And I do apologize for the sound of my voice and my nose starts to drip. I think I'm on round three of the Capitol poll that has been going through everyone. We appreciate the opportunity for you holding this public hearing today, House Bill 2508, and I will keep my comments very limited so that you can hear from folks who receive a direct impact regarding this issue. And what I'd like to do is just provide just a little bit of context for this. And going back to the current budget crisis and before, university fees, programmatic resource fees at our universities have become an increasingly important way for universities to fund program. Last session, Senator Walker, with the Senate Education Committee, folks might remember, spent considerable time looking at, and then also throughout the interim, considerable time looking at this issue of programmatic resource fees for undergraduate education. And there's actually, you'll probably hear somebody either from OUS or from one of the campuses today talk about their efforts to implement a differentiated tuition proposal. But the complicating factor on this is for graduate teachers and researchers who are employed by our universities. There's the potential of creating a two-tiered system, which has a lot of concern for our membership. And I will give the Oregon University System significant credit. They actually, my understanding is, in the budget that they forwarded to the governor, their proposal, there was some funds that were requested for addressing this issue. Obviously, in the types of budget crisis we find ourselves in at present, we're going to be looking at more potentially creative solutions than coming in with a handout. But last session, there was a standalone larger bill that talked, that a section of this addressed this issue for graduate teachers and researchers and the fees that are assessed. And I will admit that the language that we got back from legislative counsel on this bill is a little bit clunky. There are, and what we'd really like to do is be able to work with folks from the university system to come up with definitions, because I think there's a lot of confusion about who this bill is addressing. And there's also questions about the term to waive. And I think it's a mischaracterization of the intent. What we're really looking for is fees that are assessed that should be covered by the employer as a part of their tuition. So you'll hear more firsthand accounts on that today. We stand definitely ready and willing to work with folks to, like I said, to find creative solutions. And with that, what I think I'll do is turn my turn our attention over to our members who came in from the University of Oregon and Oregon State who want to share their perspective on this issue. And thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Rob Hess. I am the Vice President for Collective Bargaining of the Coalition of Graduate Employees down at Oregon State University. We represent about 1,400 graduate employees there. And I and the rest of my membership appreciate very much your willingness to give us time to testify about this bill today. So my goal is kind of to give a brief background about how this bill would affect grads at Oregon State and how fees impact us currently. I don't know how many of you on the committee have attended graduate school, but if you have, you might know that graduate employees often have their offices in basements and other kind of dreary places in the university. And graduate employees like to kind of rationalize this by joking that the university does this as an act of symbolism, to symbolize graduate students and graduate employees standing as the foundation of the university. And while we say this half in jest, nothing really could be more true. At Oregon State University, graduate teaching assistants account for 22% of the instructional FTE at Oregon State University. That means we teach 22% of the lectures, 22% of the labs, discussions, do 22% of the grading, that kind of thing, those kind of things, things that otherwise would be taken care of by faculty members. In addition, graduate research assistants accounted for nearly 500,000 man hours or human hours of research last year, and much of that is to help bring in the almost $200 million in grant money that Oregon State University receives to conduct the great research we do there. So despite our contribution, the average graduate employee at Oregon State University takes home a wage of only about $11,000 per year. Now, even though we are paid quite modestly, the university requires that we pay back anywhere between $1,500 and $3,000 in student fees every year. So that means that somebody making the average would have to pay back somewhere between 15 and 27% of their annual salary to cover the cost of student fees. And frankly, it's quite a burden on us. I've heard a lot of stories, as a representative of graduate employees, I've heard a lot of stories, some of which you'll hear in the hearing today, about how this negatively impacts graduate employees at Oregon State University. And I have to say, a lot of the stories end with the graduate employee foregoing their graduate education, taking a job in industry where they earn more and they don't have to pay money back to their employer. So I think that's an outcome that none of us want. We don't want people dropping out of graduate school in Oregon. I think we want to retain as many talented individuals in graduate school as we can. So for a long time, we've sought relief from these fees, and HB 2508 represents the relief that we've sought in requiring that student fees are waived in some form. So for that reason, I and the 1,400 graduate employees I represent urge you to please take action and pass 2508. And thank you for your time and attention. I really appreciate you taking the time to hear what we had to say.
Thank you. Please.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Glenn Morris. I am the president of the Graduate Teaching Fellows Federation, AFT Local 3544 at the University of Oregon. I'm a sixth-year PhD candidate in the Communications and Society program at the University of Oregon. And I'd just like to add before that, I had the privilege of working for you all for 5 years down in legislative media. So on the other side of those cameras. And in fact, I was one of the producers on how to testify before a legislative committee production video, training video. And let me tell you, it's a little bit different being on this side of the camera. So real briefly, we go by the nomenclature GTF, or a Graduate Teaching Fellow at the University of Oregon. We're the grad employees on campus. We teach, we lead discussion sections in labs, we grade papers, assignments, and all work, and we also research. We're researchers. Unlike OSU, we actually teach close to a third of the instructional hours at the University of Oregon, one-third of the instructional hours. Our wages, again, we're about $10,700 is the average wage, but frankly, most of our members earn around $9,000 for a salary. This $9,000, you may know, is well below the federal poverty level. Fees, the minimum amount of fees that we will have to pay is $450 every year. This represents anywhere from 4 to 5% of our salary. We consider this at the University of Oregon, at the Graduate Teaching Fellows Federation, a give back to our employer, where we have to give back a good portion of our salary to our employer. And on top of the minimum $450, there are other fees, as Rob alluded to. There are department and class fees. And just to give you an example, our brothers and sisters in the business school, those graduate workers there, they can pay up to $2,550 a year, or roughly a quarter of their salary goes to fees above and beyond the minimum. Another thing that's particularly onerous is September. So we start school in September, so we have a full fee bill, but because we start in mid-September as employees, we get half a paycheck. So we get roughly $600 paycheck, $150 of that immediately goes towards fees. We would like to acknowledge the economic crisis that is going on. Believe me, we're living in it. We have friends and family who are paying rent, who are paying mortgages, car payments, all that. Our members have children who are in public schools, so they are very well versed in the economic crisis that is underway and the budget crisis. And additionally, as I said, we live in the communities and we have food bills, utility bills, rent ourselves, so we're living the economic crisis. And just to iterate on something that Rob had mentioned earlier, when we talk about fee waivers, we're really talking about a fee remittance. In other words, we're not arguing that these fees are not good, going towards good things and useful things. We are arguing that as a give back, it's onerous for the employees to pay this amount of fees to their employer. Thank you very much for hearing us today, and look forward to working with you all.
Thank you very much. And colleagues, I'm going to open it up for questions in a moment, but wanted to give you a quick review of what we have before us this afternoon. We have five more panels after this one on this bill and the next bill, and then the work sessions on 2062 and 2063. So keep that in mind as you're asking your questions. Are there any questions?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Welcome, gentlemen. Part of the problem is that the fees are more of the cost of instruction is being shifted to fees. Is that not right? And that tends to be outside the classic model of the tuition remission. You know, I remember back when I was in graduate school, you know, back way back when you could smoke in class and do other things like that. we're talking about a long time ago, but we...
not that long ago.
No.
Sure, also represent over the glory days.
Yes. You know, a fee remission was, I mean, it was golden, right? And you knew if... And when I say fee remission, that's what we called tuition remission back then. You know, when we got a tuition remission, it meant that we would, you know, we weren't going to get a whole lot of money, but we would not have to pay tuition. And in those days, we paid very, very few fees, and they tended to be, you know, to the health clinic, you know, things like that, not really student fees. So this is probably a problem that's growing in nature, isn't it? Have you seen a growth in it yourself, Glenn, since you're a vintage PhD student.
Exactly. Madam Chair, Vice Chair Gembro, yes, fees are slowly creeping up. That's absolutely true. Now, again, we have a collective bargaining agreement, and so we have been able to, and one of my members will speak to this specifically, but we have been able to, through collective bargaining, cap those out-of-pocket costs. But the fact is, those costs are going up.
Follow-up? There are other questions for this panel? Representative Parker.
One quick one. Thank you, Madam Chair. The figures that you threw out there, percentages of instruction and average salary, stipend, whatever, those are across department?
Representative Parker, Madam Chair, members of the committee, for us that represents the entire university.
Okay.
And we got the numbers out of the OUS fact book for 2008.
Okay, great. Thanks.
Thank you. Are there Representative Maurer?
No, I'm just stunned that you're representative of a collective bargaining unit, because my experience was you fended for yourself, and so I, this was in Illinois. I just find that kind of remarkable. And it's probably a good thing, because you are the low person on the totem pole. You actually had a door. We had to, like, crawl over a wall.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Thatcher.
Thank you. Now, I'm looking at a piece of paper here, and I'm not sure if it's from one of you, Glenn Morris, because I'm so bad at names. I'm sorry. It mentions the U.S. average wage for a graduate teaching fellow. Is there an average fee? Responsibility for a GTF?
Madam Chair, Representative Thatcher, are you referring to at the University of Oregon or OUS?
Well, nationwide. You're talking about US-wide, what the wage, I guess you call it, is. Yeah, the wage is. Is there an average that you're aware of fee responsibility for the fellow?
Madam Chair, Representative Thatcher, I don't have that information. Okay. I will pass that along to my staff, and we will get that information to the committee.
Perhaps somebody out there knows.
Representative Thatcher, if I may, Chair Gelser.
Yes, please.
At Oregon State, I know that in comparison to our institutional comparator universities, we pay more than double what any of them pay in student fees. So if that provides a reference.
Ms. Madam Chair, I ask only because there. I think I'm understanding you to say you want to waive all of them. Is that correct? And I'm wondering if that is the norm for most universities around the U.S., or, I mean, I can definitely see reducing it, because that seems a little bit ridiculous and onerous, but I'm just wondering if taking them all away is really fair, too. I'm just trying to figure out what other places do.
So you can get us that information that needs.
Yeah.
That would be great.
Very
Thank
fine.
You very much.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you. And I think there was another question from... There was not another question. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Our next panel is Mary Beth Oshnek, Andre Vaughn, and Claire Elliott. Welcome. And as you begin your remarks, if you'll state your name for the record, that is very helpful for the record.
Oh. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mary Beth Oshnek. I currently reside in Corvallis, Oregon, and I'm a member of Oregon State's Coalition for Graduate Employees. I'm here to represent my fellow graduate assistants in civil engineering at Oregon State University. Thank you for inviting me here today and giving me the opportunity to give my testimony in support of House Bill 2508. The contract that I signed to become a research assistant in coastal engineering at Oregon State University stated that I'd be making a monthly gross income of $1,750. After taxes, this is around $1,400. With this knowledge, I decided to live on an on-campus apartment that would cost me $632 a month. Relocating from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania to Oregon required me to move across the country in mid-September so that I could be adequately prepared for orientation. Unfortunately, I wouldn't receive my first paycheck until October 31st, 2008, at the end of my first month of work. Having graduated from the University of Pittsburgh only 5 months prior, My financial situation was very weak, and my savings were depleted during my first 2 months of living in Oregon without an income. To make matters worse, prior to receiving my first paycheck, I received a university bill stating that I owed $1,181 in student fees. This came as a devastating shock to me, because this excessively high fee was due only 1 day after I'd finally get my first paycheck. Paying my student fees left me with $250 to live on for the month of November. This was nowhere near enough to pay my rent, in addition to the cost of food, school supplies, or living amenities for my new apartment. I couldn't help but think that maybe moving to Oregon wasn't the best decision for me. After realizing that I'd essentially forfeit one of every 3 paychecks due to student fees, I was forced to put my money on a very tight budget. Each month, I allocated $350 to paying the student fees. This deduction, plus my rent, left me with $457 a month. Payments on car and health insurance left me with $350 of monthly income. That equates to $87.50 a week. For a one-person family unit living in the United States, the poverty threshold is about $200 a week. It should be noted that this budget and comparison are based on the highest allowable graduate salary. There are students in my apartment who are expected to pay the same university bill each term on an income that's even less than my own. For a graduate student, it's difficult enough to balance research, coursework, and a reduced social life. I shouldn't also be forced to live in a financial burden due to student fees. I would personally like to thank you for your time, attention, and concern in this matter. And I sincerely hope that you take the necessary steps to eradicate student fees, which are an unnecessary burden in the life of Oregon's graduate student employees.
Thank you very much. Very well done.
So, Chair Gallagher, members of the committee, thanks a lot for inviting us to this hearing. My name is Andres Vaughn, and I'm a public policy graduate student at Oregon State University, so this field is right up my alley. I'm here to testify in support of HB 2508. Basically, as an international student, I'm here to represent not only my fellow Central American graduate students at Oregon State, but also the whole graduate student community. When I arrived here, I was aware of the existence of the fees, but the first fee that I received, just after arriving here, was roughly $1,000. And I know $1,000 here in the United States relatively is not that much money, but in my own country, it's about 2 or 3 monthly salaries. And in the country neighboring me, it's 5 or 6 monthly salaries of a professional worker. I had the savings to pay for this money myself, so I just paid for it myself. But in some cases, people have to look, they have to call their own countries, and they have to have the money wired to them. And in some cases, they don't have this possibility, so they have to maybe drop out of school or they're not able to survive. Eliminating fees, however way you do it, it is necessary for us employees at Oregon State University. I really appreciate the opportunity of listening to me and testifying in this hearing.
Thank you very much.
Chair Gelser, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Claire Elliott, and I'm a graduate student at Oregon State University in the Department of Botany and Plant Pathology, and I'm a member of the Coalition of Graduate Employees. International students arriving in Oregon to begin their studies are subject to many expenses relating to setting up a new home in Oregon and in the United States and not having any prior credit history in the country. Many international graduate students have made the decision to come to OSU based on careful budgeting of the offer made to them by the university. Further, international graduate students cannot apply for domestic financial aid. Others of us often have to send parts of our paychecks home to support families. In short, the financial situations of international graduates are often more precarious than our domestic counterparts. New graduate students at OSU often don't get their first pay until the end of October, despite beginning work halfway through September. At the same time, the first term's fees are due. For me, this was $717 out of my first paycheck of $1,468 in net pay. Somehow, students have then to afford rent and food out of whatever remains. Throughout the last year, I've had to pay school fees amounting to $2,840, despite my tuition being waived. This is 13% of my gross earnings and 17% of my net pay. Before arriving in the United States to begin my studies, I knew roughly what the cost of living in Oregon would be, and I knew what my gross paycheck would look like. But I had no knowledge of the existence of these fees on top of tuition, the tax restrictions on international students, or the extent to which not having a credit history in this country would affect me. All these factors combine, making the payment of student fees an even greater burden on us, and living month to month is only possible as long as life doesn't throw any unexpected expenses our way, such as a medical emergency or a car accident. Relief from fees on top of tuition for graduate students would allow us to meet life's challenges without going into debt and continue our studies without the constant worry of how the next rent check will be paid or how big the electricity bill might be. Not only is it necessary for grads to stop paying these fees on our small salaries, but it is in the best interest of the universities. For these reasons, I encourage you to seriously consider taking action and fixing this untenable situation for graduate employees at OSU. Thank you for holding this hearing and for the opportunity for me to testify before you today.
Thank you very much. You all did a wonderful job. Have any of you testified before to a legislative committee? You wouldn't know. You all seem very old pros. Are there any questions for this great panel?
Go
Beavers. I think that's the clear message of this particular panel. In all things, it's go Beavers, with apologies to Dex. But not
I,
me.
I would hope so.
Representative Parker, did you have a question?
Yes. Thank you, Co-Chair. Madam Chair, do you have any estimate of the dollar amount we're talking about in aggregate that would be taken out of the university budget by doing this? I don't. It's an honest, sincere question, but it's something we have to think about.
Chair Gelser, Representative Harker, members of the committee, I don't have the answer to that question, but I think that we can get the answer to you. Other members of the Coalition of Graduate Employees will be able to help you.
It seems there are other people in the audience who do have this information that we're going to hear later. So thank you very much for your testimonies.
Thank you. Representative Springer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm clearly seeing a theme arise here. How, and I just ask this simply, I guess, it sounds like the fees are a surprise. How is that?
Chair Gosler, members of the committee, I know CGE is working now, like starting in January, any new graduate students will be warned of these fees, but when I signed my contract to come here, I had no warning of them whatsoever. So they were a surprise to all of us, I know.
Representative Gosler, members of the committee, it's the same case for me. I wasn't aware in the main letters that I received when I was accepted my graduate school education of this fees, at least in all the letters that were received.
Representative Roblin?
Yeah, just a short comment, because I have two family members, a daughter and a son-in-law, who are graduate assistants at other universities, and their fees were covered. So it is an interesting fact to me. I was in a different state, but they did cover them, and the fees were considerably less than the fees we're talking about right now, which is shocking because this was a private school. I would have thought they might have done more, but just a comment, and I appreciate hearing what you've said.
Thank you, Representative Roblin. Representative Van Orman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Are you paid 12 months of the year or 9 months?
We're paid for 12.
You're paid for 12. Well, I would say that this is very reminiscent of Head Start pay.
Thank you.
Which isn't saying much, I'm afraid.
We'll get better.
But I'm only paid for 12 because I do research all
for
summer.
12. Yeah,
I don't
right.
know if it's the same for TAs that are teaching classes.
I'm paid for 9.
Okay.
There you go.
So, yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for coming today. Our next panel is Jonathan Peacock, Skylar Weaver, and Ben Hirschberg. Are you all ducks?
Beavers.
Ah. Would they admit it at this point?
We do have ducks on this committee as well.
It must be worse at Oregon State.
I think it is, actually.
Please, so as you begin your comments, please state your name for the record.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jonathan Peacock, and I'm a member of the Coalition for Graduate Employees, and I thank you very much for having me here to speak today. I come before you as an appointed graduate teaching assistant in the Department of English at Oregon State University, and a vessel for the nearly universally held opinions of both that department and members of CGE with regard to House Bill 2508. As a hardworking teaching assistant in an often forgotten department, I strongly support the legislative measure in question. As many of you have been told from the introductory information that you received, most graduate employees do not receive wages above the poverty line. And while this is an alarming statistic, it simply does not capture the overwhelming panic and frustration associated with having what little money we do earn as graduate employees taken from us to satisfy nearly endless lists of student fees that are neither adequately explained in many cases or justified. Of course, I can see that student fees are an important source of supplementary revenue for the university. However, often forgotten are the detrimental impacts of taking an additional large sum of money from an already low salary. In the English department, for example, student fees amount to more than 15% of our gross pay. Now, we've heard testimony from other departments, and we've been told, and you've been told, that the average graduate teaching assistant salary is around $11,000. For the case of the English department, it's more like $9,400. The rest falls victim to health insurance premiums, state and federal income taxes, and other necessities that we have to pay for as the term goes on. So given the current condition of the economy, many graduate employees, myself included, have trouble making ends meet, to say the least. And personally, my specific expenses, including groceries, rent, utilities, and other basic living supplies, are only satisfied through great difficulty. Additionally, providing due consideration for my fellow graduate employees who are also parents, the duty of satisfying the needs of a family on a salary that is injured by student fees becomes increasingly challenging. So passing House Bill 2508, will make surviving in the already chaotic world of graduate employment much more manageable. A waiver of student fees for me means having access to doctor visits without fear of not having enough money to pay rent. It means being able to afford all the groceries and supplies my family requires rather than only those we can afford. And most importantly, a waiver of fees for me stands as a reminder that the state of Oregon cares about its graduate employees enough to assist in their continued financial survival while trudging through the maze of higher education. I thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today, and I will pass it on.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Ben Hirschberg, and I'm a student in electrical engineering at Oregon State. Before I begin, I have a question. I think I have an answer to a couple of the questions that were asked in the last group. First of all, according to the information I have here from CGE at Oregon State, the cost, at least at Oregon State, of this proposed bill would be less than 0.25% of OSU's total budget. And I also want to clarify that also might not be that bad even. For instance, in my case, my professor has grant money, which is used to pay my tuition waiver. However, grant money, the stipulation on it is that it cannot be applied to fees for the university, so he actually has no option for helping me out with any kind of assistance of that. So if this was classified under the like larger umbrella of tuition, then he would be able to provide like that financing for me just through grant money independent of OSU's budget. So, Chair Gelsler, members of the committee, my name is Ben Hirschberg, as I said, and I'm here to testify in support of HB 2508. I'm a PhD candidate in electrical engineering at Oregon State, and I've served as a teaching assistant and run undergraduate labs in the past, but these days my time is purely devoted to research. It's from this perspective, that of a technical graduate research assistant, that I would like to address the committee. But first, let's back up for a moment and talk personal finances. When all is said and done, in the 10-week period that a single academic term covers, over 28% of my fees, salary goes to fees. To put this in context, I lose much more from my paycheck in student fees than I do from combined state and federal taxes. To cover the cost of living that my stipend does not, I work a second job doing website development. In this job, I earn an hourly wage that is 2.5 times that which I am paid as a graduate research assistant. I can't stress the symbolism of that disparity enough. It underlies the insidious truth that is leeching indigenous talent away from U.S. universities. People do not want to spend several years of their life living below the poverty line when there is a job with good pay and benefits knocking at their door. The ability of our nation to provide sufficient support to its researchers is directly related to the ability of the U.S. to remain a competitive force in science and technology. There just isn't enough incentive for U.S. citizens in the field of science and technology to continue their education onto the graduate level. I paid $960 in fees last term. $430 of this was an engineering resource fee. These fees are a subtle way to make it look like graduate students are being paid more than they actually are. When I agreed to come to Oregon State University for my graduate studies, it was under the pretense that the stipend would be fully applicable to my living expenses. In reality, however, I don't have a full tuition waiver. I have a 77% tuition waiver, and the other 23% in the form of fees I must pay directly out of my salary. The official response of my department to the question, why as a graduate student are my fees not covered in the tuition waiver, is as follows. Most funding agencies will only cover the cost of tuition and not fees. We recognize the need to have fees covered as well, and we will look for ways to address this for both research assistants and teaching assistants. So I think my school's administration acknowledges the validity of our concerns, and I appreciate that they're looking for ways to resolve the problem. But I've seen zero progress in this area in the 6.5 years that I've been a student at Oregon State University. Action on this issue is ultimately going to come down to a matter of state legislation. I implore you to support the graduate students in Oregon, not only for the sake of those for whom it most directly impacts, but for our state as a whole. Without bright minds, our economy cannot move forward. Thank you for holding this hearing and giving me the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Skylar Weaver, and I am a PhD student in electrical engineering at Oregon State University. I've been a graduate student there for 3 years, and my fiance and I are both graduate assistants at Oregon State. I'm a research assistant, she's a teaching assistant. And because of the amount of money that we're given each month, we sat down with a spreadsheet, we made a very nice budget, and even had like a little happy cat and a sad cat, depending on, we would punch in like how much we could put in savings, how much we couldn't put in. If we spend more in the month, then we would have a sad cat. It was a happy cat. So of course we had to put the fees in there, because that was something we definitely had to pay. So it came down to it.
Did the fee come with a sad cat or a happy cat?
What's that?
Did the fee generate a sad cat?
Oh, it was a sad cat. Yeah. So we had to put no money into savings, and in fact, any savings we did have was negative. So we had to take money out of savings just to live. But we made a happy cat in the end, so it was worth it.
Carry on.
Okay. Okay. So when it comes down to look at how much we actually have to pay in fees per term, our combined fee is $1,665, and that's $555 per month that we have to pay combined together, and that ends up being 22% of our net pay in the end. And so it was very, very tough. You have to wait for the paycheck to come so you can pay rent, but it was okay. You could do that, because once the paycheck comes, you have money to pay rent. So it was fine. Cats were happy. Everything's good. But then I dislocated my shoulder and had to go to the emergency room, and that cost money for the ambulance and then being in the hospital. And then we were behind, and there was no way for us to make that back up. And so I fortunately was able to wait, and it was on my birthday. I was able to get birthday money so I could play a little bit of birthday money to the fees. But I only get birthday once a year. So we realized we're going to have to take out a loan.
Yeah, I think there's a bill right there.
Birthday money is required. So now we're actually going to have to apply for a loan. And the loan is 100% just so that we can pay for the student fees and keep ourselves afloat until we can graduate and actually make real money at a job. So I am a research assistant, 100% as a research assistant. So I spend all of my time doing research and writing publications for the university, and that helps Oregon State University. It makes it look better as we publish. And I published twice, once in Japan and once in Morocco, and so this is good. And then from that research, I've also wrote a grant proposal for my professor, and we actually were able to bring in some Air Force money, and then this was good. But even the same month, in the same term that the grant was approved and the money came to my professor so that he could do our tuition waivers, I was still charged $1,000 in fees that term. That, it's crazy. It's the only job I've ever had that they actually charged me a fee to do my job. It's bizarre. So in the end, the reason that really seems most unfair to me is the fact that I am given a check and I'm given money, and then I have to pay that money back. And since they know exactly how much money that they're giving me and exactly how much money they're charging me, it's that it increases my total taxable income, and it makes me less eligible for things like federal aid and other scholarships that I may be able to have if I had lower taxable income. And so that just doesn't seem fair to me. So. That's all I have to say. Thank you very much for allowing us to come testify today. Thank you.
Thank you. And I have a quick question for this panel, and it might be for Rob when you come back. I was kind of kidding about whether or not you were all from Oregon State or the University of Oregon, but can you talk a little bit? It's my understanding that there's, and I could be totally wrong, that there's a difference in the way this issue is handled between the two campuses, the University of Oregon and Oregon State. Can you talk a little bit about that, or do we have someone later that is going to be talking about that?
Chair Gelsler. I don't know the answer to that question specifically. Now, as I said, I am from Oregon State University.
Okay.
Since that's the case, I don't know much about the policy at U of O.
All right.
But we can certainly find that out for you.
All right. Yeah. Thank you very much. All right. Are there any other questions for this panel? Representative Van Orman.
Yeah. I was sort of serious about the Head Start statement because I paid teachers, and I certainly paid them more than minimum wage, and I also did not ask for any back. And in my calculations of the $8.40 an hour, which I believe minimum wage is currently, that's $1,455 a month. Is that approximately close to what you're being paid?
Madam Chair and Representative Orman, thank you for your question. To answer it shortly, no. For me, anyway, at least for in the department, we are paid, as I'm a teaching assistant, we are paid based on FTE. And so in a term where I teach one class, I could be paid as little as approximately $650 per month. And now, for example, in this term, the winter term, I'm teaching two classes currently, and the pay is around that amount, about $1,400, which almost satisfies the minimum wage requirement. So it is, at least for a teaching assistant, it varies from department to department. So.
Follow-up? But of course, once you take the fees out, you're below minimum wage.
Yes, far below, actually, yes.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Dembro.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just following up on Representative Roblin's earlier point about his son, daughter-in-law.
Daughter and son-in-law.
You know, their tuition remission pays for, it covers their fees. And I assume in part that's because, you know, that school has chosen to wrap its fees together with its tuition. And I'm wondering if most schools are doing that, and actually this is a question for you, Ben. You made the point that most grants don't pay for fees, and is that because this is less of a problem at other schools because fees at most schools really are personal fees as opposed to student fees?
Representative Gelsler and the rest of the committee. To answer your question, I think the reason why we see the fees in this case, my understanding, as I spoke to Dennis, who's the president of CGA at Oregon State, or I guess past president, correct? Anyway, His explanation to me is that the Oregon University system as a whole, if it's classified as tuition, then it goes to OUS. If it's classified as fees, then it can be recirculated directly back to the university. And so by increasing fees, it's a way of providing income directly back to, like, Oregon State, for instance.
Okay,
does that answer your question?
Yeah, and we'll probably be hearing from OUS about this. Thank you.
Representative Kopp, just a comment for committee, and maybe staff could do a little research on this. We've had other bills that we've been talking about, the Oregon administrative rules that accompany these bills and the intent. And I would be curious about any administrative rules there are on this topic, and if there aren't any, then we might need to give a little more direction within this bill.
Thank you, Representative Kopp. Representative Springer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ben, this question's for you, and I guess I'm simply asking you because you started to surface this issue a little bit. In brief, can you explain the other benefits that you receive as a graduate assistant? You talked about your professor sometimes gives you some tuition waiver. So talk about the benefits in addition to the stipend that you receive.
Okay, Representative Gelser, the rest of the committee. In terms of benefits, can you be more specific? From my professor, so he gets grant funding, mm-hmm. and then he can apply that towards paying. Well, it's actually a little bit interesting. He pays my tuition waiver. He also pays for my facilities. He keeps the power on. He gives me computers, lab supplies, everything I need. Then I also pay fees to provide myself with lab supplies to the university. But actually, I don't actually see any of that. When you actually look at the way that the fees are distributed, it's not quite the case. So there's a little bit of double paying going on with these fees as well, from the professor side, the grant money side, and then from the student side. But that's kind of really more of a departmental issue than the bill that we're discussing here, I think. As far as other benefits, as a graduate student, we receive subsidies on health insurance, for example. We receive, I think, an 85% subsidy on health insurance provided to the university.
85%?
I believe that's correct, yeah.
I think so.
Okay, thank you. Representative Parker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to follow up on both of the questions asked by Representative Springer. More recent one first, I guess. The spreading out of the cost across across grants and non-grant funds, that's pretty tricky. It has to do with, is this, depends on the agency, the federal agency that's bringing in the funds, depends on the indirect cost rates negotiated by the institution, depends on departmental policies, etc. You, however, kind of get caught in the middle in a bunch of this stuff. You asked earlier about fees being unknown, and I was kind of wondering the same thing. You know, why is it a surprise? I just put my daughter through undergrad, and we knew what the fees were. We argued about who was going to pay them, but in the end, she won, and I paid. And I'm a sucker, I guess. But anyway,
wait for an argument to learn that.
Just keep learning it over and over again. But I'm on the U of O site, I'm on the OSU site, and I see many fees. Now, you folks are all beavers, I believe, so there's not quite as much info there, but I've got, you know, the tech fees and the matriculation fees and varying other fees here. U of O fees section lists a whole lot more. You're saying that there were fees you anticipated, made your budgets coming into it, and there are other ones that are just not described here online. You were kind of blindsided by these things. You honestly believe,
Madam Chair and committee. I actually just recently, because just for this last term, I was switched to being a TA instead of an RA,
mm-hmm.
because my professor, one of his TAs, was gone. He wanted me to do it, and so just to do that, they had to make me sign a new offer letter. And in the offer letter, it talks about tuition waiver, and it tells me what my living stipend is going to be.
Mm-hmm.
And then this is what I have to sign, and then I have to have some other people sign it. But nowhere in there does it say anything about any cert fees.
Okay, thanks.
And this was only the last January.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Are there any further questions for this panel? No, thank you very much. For the next panel, bring up an extra chair. I'm going to call up four people so that no one's stuck on their own. Brian Detel, Chris Knudsen,
Libby Schoen and Scott. Scott.
Scott.
Okay. Last name is first.
That's really amazing.
Scott.
She's so absolutely familiar. I can't help this
one. No, she's got to be in the university system someday.
She what?
Has to be in the university system.
She's
been
around it forever.
Please go ahead.
Chair Gelser. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Brian Tell. I've been a graduate teaching assistant in mathematics at Oregon State University for 6 years and a member of the Coalition of Graduate Employees for 6 years also. During those 6 years, I've seen fees increase. Every year, a larger percentage of my salary is directed towards fees. This is a problem. This system needs to be fixed. As you've just heard from the previous testimony, graduate employees at Oregon State University are required to give between 10 and 30% of their pre-tax income directly back to their employer in fees. 30%. And we know that this isn't going to disappear. The fees are here. They're necessary in some senses, and they're going to continue to increase. If something isn't done now, we'll be back here in the next session complaining about how we have to pay 30% or 40% or 50% even of our salary and fees. We're already among the lowest paid graduate employees in the nation, and every year a greater percentage of our salary is taken by fees. And even if this passes, we'll still be among the lowest paid in the nation. However, at least our compensation won't decrease every year due to fees. I personally know of graduate employees that have left Oregon to go to other states because of this. And by fixing this loophole, Oregon State University will not only be able to save money on recruitment for graduates, but also recruit better graduate employees, which will increase research funding and the reputation of the university. Even though I know this costs money, for us, it doesn't seem like it's about money. It's about fairness. The university often uses fees to take things that were funded through the general fund and pay shifts that program to pay for with fees. I've witnessed this firsthand 2 years ago. I was involved in student government, and they slashed funding to student services, and then to make up for that, they created a resource registration fee to pay for the budget cuts. What point is it to have a tuition waiver when they can when the university has the ability to take things that were paid for with tuition and make them fee-based? By repeatedly cutting tuition-based programs and then raising fees to cover the cuts, Oregon State University has made our tuition waiver meaningless. This bill will help fix that system, and something needs to be done, even if it's not this bill. It's just going to keep getting worse, and something has to be done. Thank you for your time and the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you.
Chair Gelser and members of the committee, I'm Scott Naradka. I'm a graduate teaching fellow at the University of Oregon, and I'm in the art department. I was asked to speak today because the art department pays some of the most fees in the university. Previously, Glenn Morris said that we only paid 4% of the fees or something of salary, but that's just a mandatory fee. There's a lot of other additional fees that different departments pay. For instance, in my first term here, I paid $514 in mandatory fees, which $218 was remitted by the university according to our contract, so that comes out to like $300-ish. I had to pay a $50 printmaking lab fee, which goes to the maintenance of the printmaking labs. My job is to maintain the printmaking labs, and I also teach one of the classes. So I was paying a fee to pay my own salary. We also have to pay art fees, which $6 art fee every term, which just goes to the departmental budget because it's a departmental fee. I had to pay a $250 matriculation fee. We had to pay $125 architecture and art resource fees, which I suppose goes to pay to computer labs, but I'm not entirely clear. And then for each class we take, we have to pay a material issue ticket, which is supposed to go to pay for the supplies we use in class, which would be fair. But $20 off the top goes to the general art department budget, and material issue tickets now are used to pay for things like this quarter, I they wanted to get another visiting artist to come in, pass their budget, so they assigned everybody a $40 material issue ticket to have a visiting artist come in, which is usually always paid before. And then there's also about 15 classes in my department where they replace the tuition entirely with fees. They're like, this is a self-support class, and you have to pay $800 in fees, and your tuition waiver does not cover it. So no one in our department that's a graduate student can take these classes, even though they're offered at the graduate level. So my first term here, I paid $861 in fees, and my monthly salary was $798. And when I came to U of O, I came because of the tuition waiver. I got a call, U of O art department is probably second tier school. It's not the best. It's a good school. But I was like, wow, I could go to graduate school for free, and I'll be paid to go teach, and this sounds great. I'll get teaching experience. And I had the conversation on the phone, and that seemed great. And they're like, oh, okay. And at some point in line, they said fees, but I'm like, oh, they're $200 a quarter. That's bad, but I can pay that. You know, my undergraduate, we had to pay for the health center, stuff like that. That's what I was assuming it was. And then when I get here, my paycheck was late. I didn't get paid my first month due to a paperwork error. And when I did get my paycheck, it was less than what I owed the university. So for my first 2 months here were not the best months of my life. I pretty much showed up with my moving costs, everything else. I used up my entire life savings in my first two quarters there. And then after that, it was never as bad as the first quarter. I paid $631 in fees next term, $591 in the spring, $827 last two terms, or $500 in last two terms. I only make $800 a month. So the first paycheck I get every term, because I get three paychecks a term, is pretty much gets entirely eaten by the fees I have to pay. Our department's about the second worst at the U of O, and everybody in my department complains about the fees. At the beginning of every quarter, everyone's grumbling. It's not just a small issue, and our options are to take out a whole bunch of loans to pay for these, but we're going in as artists and art educators. We don't have a secure future. I went to the University of Oregon, so I could be responsible and not rack up debt that I could possibly not repay. So, thank you.
Thank you very much. Please.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Elizabeth Shaney, and I am a sixth-year PhD candidate in the physics department at the University of Oregon. I am also an officer of the Graduate Teaching Fellows Federation, AFT Local 3544. I am here to testify about House Bill 2508. Okay, we at the GTFF have sought to reduce and eliminate our fees through collective bargaining since 1995, and we've managed to cap them that year at $214 a quarter. Now, this is just the minimum fee that every graduate student must pay. This isn't including departmental fees like Scott just spoke about. This cap is renegotiated every 2 years when we bargain our contract and has been as high as $275 per quarter in the past. With the House Bill 2508, we aim to end this source of variability in graduate teaching fellows' yearly budgets. Though it may seem unreasonable to add additional financial strain on an institution already stretched thin in dire economic times, I urge you to consider the fees from the graduate teaching fellows' point of view. And I realize a lot of people have spoken their personal stories already. You work for the university, teaching a class or leading a discussion section for about $12 an hour. Though the pay is meager, your employer waives the tuition you owe for the classes you take as a graduate student in recognition of the valuable work you perform for them. Then, 4 months out of the year, you are required to pay a portion of your monthly paycheck back to your employer. In some circumstances, it's almost 100% of it. What appears as a small amount of money to the university can have a significant impact on the tight budget of a graduate teaching fellow. What should she cut? Can he shift anything around? There's groceries, rent, and childcare, in addition to many other responsibilities. In budgets with little room for discretionary spending, student fees are an onerous burden. Adding to the economic strife is backward logic that employee must turn right around and give back a portion of what she just earned back to her employer. I ask, Madam Chair and members of the committee, that you consider fees on par with tuition, thereby waiving the entirety of expenses incurred as a graduate student for those who work as graduate teaching fellows performing invaluable work at the University of Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Let's finish the panel first, and then we'll do questions.
Sorry. Well, I'm going to be very quick, Chair Gelser. Chair Gelser and members of the committee, I removed my testimony because of the redundance of it, and we were trying to actually stress how much it costs the individual graduate student. Well, my testimony was based on how the fees are assessed and what the issues are with that. I've been an active member in the collective bargaining for CGE. My name is Christopher Knutson. I'm in the chemistry department of Oregon State University. I live in Corvallis. But I've been an active member in the bargaining, and I found it very unfair, the contractual letter that they sent me. So I was actively participated in bargaining to include fees in the offer letter and contractual process for the incoming graduate students, because it was an utter surprise to me to arrive at Oregon State University and have to pay those fees. I had other offer letters from other universities that detailed fees. However, Oregon State University did not, and through bargaining, active participation in bargaining, that has been changed for future generations of graduate students coming into the university. So people will be informed in the future of what pretty much all of us were not informed of when we got there, and that was that, hey, your first months are going to be really, really hard for you.
Thank you very much. Representative Maurer.
Madam Chair, just a comment. As a small business owner, former as of last Sunday, we would call those taxes.
Thank you, Representative. Are there any further questions for this panel? Representative Van Orman.
I just have a comment for Scott, just to let you know. He had talked about uncertainty of jobs after he gets out of school, and I just want you to know that I am a graduate. I have an art ed degree from the University of Oregon in the same school you're in, and look what's happened to me.
And the pay's about
the
same.
Yeah, the pay, right.
Yeah, good thing, bad thing.
Sorry, ma'am. I wasn't in the queue.
No, that is fantastic, and it crossed my mind as well. Are there any further questions or comments for this panel? No, thank you all. Oh, Representative Parker.
What am I, chopped liver?
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good job on making the improvements for the future.
Yeah, I was very upset when I found out, as many other people were, and the only way that we could actually deal with it is through collectively bargaining over the contract language.
Mm-hmm. I also decided to log into University of Michigan, which is where I did my doctoral work, and I was... There's a whole lot more info there. I don't know anything about the letters that are being sent out by the different institutions, but
very
good job.
True.
Are there any further questions for this panel? No, thank you very much. And last we have Nancy Heiligman.
Chair Gelser, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Nancy Heiligman, Associate Vice President for Finance and Administration at Oregon State University. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today on House Bill 2508. As you've heard today, graduate students contribute in many ways to the teaching, research, and public service missions of the university. Attracting top graduate students to OSU is critical to the strength and vitality of the university, and holding down costs for graduate students is one of our priorities. But I am here today to speak in opposition to House Bill 2508 based on the current fiscal realities facing our state and the university. We estimate that this bill would increase the expenses for graduate education at OSU by $6 million in the next biennium. OSU would feel the greatest impact of this bill. The other universities in the system estimate in total a $7 million impact, with a total impact for the university system of $13 million for the next biennium. As Mr. Wagner mentioned, the Oregon University System Board submitted a policy package request to the governor that would have provided $5 million annually to support graduate education across the system to help reduce educational resource fees. Due to the financial shortfall, the package was not included in the governor's recommended budget. At OSU, graduate tuition for resident students costs $9,400 per year, approximately, and that is the amount that is remitted. Mandatory fees cost about $1,600 a year. In addition, students pay educational resource fees that average $190 per year, but those vary based on the major, so some students pay less, some pay more. OSU has taken a number of steps to remain competitive and to keep graduate education affordable over the last several years. Tuition and mandatory fees have increased by an average of 2.8% annually over the last three biennia at Oregon State. Educational resource fees for graduate students have been frozen since 2004 based on the bargaining agreement with CGE. Last year, OSU awarded $3.3 million in college-based graduate scholarships and fellowships. And awards are up for this year, currently estimated at about an 8% increase. 2 years ago, the university bargained a $750 annual stipend for graduate assistants to help offset a portion of the student fees. For this academic year, the stipend has been increased to $900 a year. I served on a committee last session that was composed of OUS administrators and students working with Senator Walker on educational resource fees. And as you've heard from many of the students today, one of the issues is transparency. And that some students get when they don't understand, don't realize that there are additional fees involved in their education. So we have done quite a bit of work, particularly in the undergraduate area. All universities have rolled undergraduate educational resource fees into tuition or into differential tuition. OSU is currently developing a proposal to roll educational resource fees into tuition for graduate students based on the need for this greater transparency and also to help reduce the cost of attendance. Four other OSU campuses have already done that. I believe U of O is considering that change for this fall, and Oregon Institute of Technology is the other campus, and I didn't have a chance to talk to them this week to see where they are in that change. At OSU, we would expect that change would be made not this fall, but in the fall of 2010. In summary, the university is very concerned about the cost of graduate education and Oregon State's ability to continue to compete for talented graduate students, particularly over the long term. But the university simply cannot afford the cost of eliminating these fees during this current financial crisis. Those are my comments, and I'd be happy to answer any questions if you have some.
Thank you very much, Representative Springer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You touched on the issue that I'm trying to drill down on a little bit here in your last bullet when you talked about greater transparency and the cost of the attendance. Mm-hmm. I guess, can you briefly outline the process currently, not with this in mind, currently in how these fees are communicated? Because I just, right now I'm sitting here either amazed or appalled or whatever that there's these surprise fees. So how do we get from, I think it's taken care of, to, oh my goodness?
Chair Gelzer, Representative Springer, there is a fee process that each university goes through every spring. And the university sets fees, does involve students in that discussion. In fact, many of these fees, the mandatory fees, are set by students in consultation with the presidents of the university. There is a public hearing held each year on campus and an official administrative rule hearing held by the university system every year in April or May, right? Usually late spring. And then the Oregon University System Board hears the fee proposals in June of each year, and again, it's a public session, and sets fees, tuition and fees each year. In terms of the offer letters that you heard, those at Oregon State University are handled at the department level, and so it would not surprise me if there were variation across the university in those letters. I wasn't aware of the bargaining issue. You know, that issue has been fixed going forward, but that is something that where I think you would see different letters from different departments across the colleges and across the university.
Quick follow-up here.
Mm-hmm. So in the process of coming to this agreement and getting to the point where contracts are signed, where do these fees come up?
The fees are on our website. They are, I guess for a graduate student, they would have to look up the tuition. They would have to, go to the website. Look at the fees, look at tuition. They are posted in several different places. One of the things that Oregon State and all of the OUS universities are working on is greater transparency, making it easier to understand the fees on our websites. Oregon State has also implemented what we've called a fee calculator so that a student can go to the website, because fees can vary based on your student level, based on your major. And so you can go dial all those different variables into this fee calculator and calculate your fees. We at the university have agreed that the educational resource fees in particular are, kind of difficult to understand. Students don't always see those. They don't always understand that will apply to them. And that's the reason for this proposal to fold them into fees, or fold them into tuition, excuse me. And again, that we're going to take our time and process that through the university, working with students. We'll have to bargain that if we do decide to do that. That is the plan right now at Oregon State.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Harker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks for the info. And in spite of what we all want to do, there's no free lunch here, right? Somebody's going to have to pay for some of these things. You referred to the OUS request for $5 million annually. That would have been an increase of how much over what you're currently provided?
Currently, Madam Chair, Representative Parker, we are provided through the formula. It's the resource allocation formula for the university system, a small amount to support graduate education in general. I don't have that number in my mind.
Do we, the state, provide you with anything for graduate student fees on a per-student basis? I shouldn't have said fees there. Do we provide any support on a per-graduate student basis?
Yes, there is a line in it's a targeted program within the resource allocation model for graduate education, and I don't have that number in my mind. But
I wouldn't carry it around either.
Right.
Do you have a feel for where we rank nationally?
I have a good feeling for that. In terms of state support for education, we rank 45th or 46th currently among states.
This is fueling my mantra, you know.
I know.
What are we, a third world state?
Thank you, Representative Parker. Representative Dimbro, do you have a question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah. I thank Representative Parker for that comment. But And I thank you, Nancy, for coming before us and for all the good work that you do. So, and I applaud the university in moving towards this plan to roll the resources fees into tuition. But it sounds as if that's going to be a function of the university's allocation, right? The ability to complete that program, and first of all. And then second, it'll still leave the problem of departmental fees, right? Can you give us an idea of how the expense to a typical student of the resource fees compares to the departmental?
Thank you. Representative Gelser, Representative Dembro. Yes, the resource fee plan, I believe, will go forward despite our funding difficulties. Now, again, we haven't made the decision, but we're talking very seriously about doing that despite the current budget situation. The course fees or departmental fees, those amounts can have a big impact on certain students, they're a relatively small fee to the university. I would say, overall across our entire university, we probably raise about $2 million on course fees. So that isn't, they're often $10 here or $20 there. The complaint that we hear from students about those is it's sort of nickeling and diming you. You know, it's just one more fee. Really, the largest fees are the mandatory fees. And the current fees that are mandatory for grad students are about $500 per term. The largest by far of that is the incidental fee. About half of that is incidental fees, which support student activities. And then the others are health fee, which covers the student health center, the building fee, which is set by the legislature, and the technology fee, which supports computer labs and other technology services for students. So those are the, $1,600 per year that are really the most largest fees. Mm-hmm.
And just follow up. And in the plan, would those be rolled into tuition?
Those fees would not be rolled into tuition.
Thank you. Representative Thatcher.
Thank you. I'm just looking at your testimony here, and you refer to them, these teaching or research assistants or graduate teaching fellows as employees, correct?
Correct.
Do universities have a special exemption from normal employment law?
Representative Gelser, Representative Thatcher, no. Our employees are all subject to state and federal regulations and laws.
Okay. Follow up. I guess I ask that because as an employer myself, I know that we're very limited on what we can deduct from an employee's payroll. And I didn't see anything about fees on there, but there's laws, for instance, about uniforms and equipment and tools and things like that. It says, unless they're for the employee's benefit and authorized in writing. Are these deductions authorized in writing by these employees?
Representative Thatcher, the fees are, the graduate assistants are students and their employees, and we do not deduct fees from their paychecks. Those are separate functions. So we issue paychecks to students as employees, and then we send them a bill for fees as a student. So it is two separate processes. And no, I think you're correct. I don't believe that we could deduct fees from someone's paycheck.
Okay, I'm sorry. That was kind of how I was hearing this. And I was hearing how, just one more follow-up, how they would get this big, hefty fee bill. That seems rather harsh. My daughter went to U of O, and these things would just come due, and just they're hefty. And I'm wondering, is there a way you could look at maybe structuring those in a way that's more affordable?
Representative Thatcher, that's a very good question. And at OSU, I believe that we are the only university in the system that does allow students leeway on their bills. Students are allowed to accumulate up to $2,200 for two terms, I believe it is, so that if they can't, you know, if they get into a cash crunch, it does allow them a little bit of time and flexibility to make their payments.
Thank you. Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Nancy, thank you for your testimony. I won't shoot the messenger. I'm looking forward to discussing this further. I think we've identified some problems here. You know, in the legislature, we try to set policy and try to make Oregon number one, not number 47.
49.
Or 49, depending on the case. And it's always frustrating to have a committee hearing like this and find out some of the reasons that were never brought to us before as to probably why we are lacking in some of our research and not number one in research in certain areas or whatever the case might be. Regarding the fees, if they were freshmen entering college and had never had the experience of higher ed before, I could understand mistaking fees or whatever, but I think most of you guys are probably pretty bright or you wouldn't be where you are, and there was a pretty uniform message that the fees came as a surprise. From private industry, Bureau of Labor and Industries would have had me back here had I tried to pull something like this. And I know we're not going to resolve this today, but I'm excited about having more testimony from OUS and try to drill down. And I also understand that, you know, we have heard in testimony today that tuition is rolled into the package. And so when you look at the whole package, each one of you, you know, it probably amounts to a considerable amount each year, but it still doesn't forgive the fact that they can't eat or make a living. So, anyway, thanks for coming today, and I look forward to more testimony.
Thank you, Representative Huffman, and thank you very much. Thank you all for bringing this to our attention. And with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2508. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2487 for the purpose of holding it over until next Wednesday. We have a work session that we need to complete. Is there anyone here for House Bill 2487 that will not be able to come back? Seeing none, thank you. So this is held over until next Wednesday, which would be March 11th. And I'm closing the public hearing on House Bill 2487. I'm opening a work session on House Bill 2062. Colleagues, House Bill 2062 is a bill that we have heard before in this committee that has undergone a lot of work over the course of the last couple of weeks. I'd specifically like to thank Representative Huffman, Representative Dembro, and Representative Springer for work that they have done in a work group to find a bill that can be implemented that will keep our kids safe. I think it's also important right before we go through the amendments to the bill to acknowledge the tremendous work of our K-12 partners. That includes the Oregon Educationists Association, the Oregon School Employees Association, the Oregon School Boards Association, and the Coalition of Oregon School Administrators, all of whom have put hours and hours and attorney time into putting this together. It's really something remarkable to see the attorneys of all of these organizations, who are often in adversarial positions by nature of their work, come together focused on the of a single mind, and that is why we have a great bill here. So we owe a tremendous debt of gratitude to our educational partners, and thank you. And also to legislative fiscal, you will notice that these fiscal statements are hot off of the presses. Legislative Counsel Hannah Lai and Erica down in Legislative Fiscal have really done somersaults to get this in front of us today so that we can do it. If you see them around, please offer them their thanks for the work they're doing for this committee. And I'm going to bring them cookies on Monday. So I'm just grateful to all these folks. So again, House Bill 2062, to give you a quick overview of this, has actually rolled into it, and I'm going to give the work group members an opportunity to chime in here in a minute too. It becomes a combination of the bill that we previously heard and a bill that was also being heard over on the Senate side, which was Senate Bill 45. And that bill had to do with grooming behaviors and things that might be signals that something that is abuse may occur later. Some people have used the technical term to describe that as icky. The word icky does not appear in the bill. But it quickly became clear that we couldn't discuss these two. It doesn't, does it? Okay. Look back there. I read it. I didn't see it there. And so it was very difficult to address these issues on their own. So what this bill essentially does, it requires hiring education agencies. This applies to both public and private schools to contact at a minimum the previous three employers of the potential school employee. It requires the potential school employee to provide that provider with the contact information for those previous employees. And what will happen is the question will be asked, have there been any substantiated allegations of sexual conduct, and that is the term that we are given to grooming behaviors, or child abuse, while this employee has been in your employ? And the way that this question will be answered is through a form that will state either no, there have never been any allegations that have been substantiated, or it will list that there's a substantiated allegation, the date of the substantiated allegation, and the dates of employment. When the employer substantiates the allegation, they will inform the employee that they have due process rights, and those are either through the collective bargaining agreement, or for those individuals who do not have an appeal process described in their collective bargaining agreement, it would be a neutral third-party process, and that would be paid for. The financial responsibility for that would lay with the school district. The bill also preserves the language banning secret agreements. There will be no secret agreements that will be allowed in the state of Oregon, and that includes disclosure of whether or not there is an ongoing investigation into sexual misconduct or abuse at the time that that employment decision is being considered. We also have in here definitions of substantiated, which we discussed at length last time. We also have a definition of investigation, and we have a definition of sexual conduct. It's a very good bill. The amendments that we're prepared to move today and that I hope we will move today are the Dash 8 amendments. And with that, I would, starting with Representative Huffman, see if there are other comments to be added by work group members.
Thank you, Chair Gelzer. This started in February of 2008. And I was assigned to a task force to start working on this after it was brought to the legislature's attention because of some Oregonian articles entitled Pass the Trash. When we started the work group, we were tasked with trying to make sure that school districts could not make secret deals. So the product that we're talking about today is head and shoulders, I believe, above what we started out, what we were tasked for. And I think we've closed a lot of loopholes. I think we've defined procedures. For anyone that knows me and knows my heart, over the last 13 months, I've been accused of trying to protect teachers at the risk of hurting kids. That's certainly not the case. We were trying to come up with a complete package that would protect kids first, but not step on innocent people's rights. And we evolved into more than just teachers. We're looking at all school employees. So I think the finished product here is outstanding, and I'm very proud of it. And I thank everybody I echo Chair Gelser. I mean, Senator Walker, Representative Buckley, Representative Flores, Don Phillips. I mean, there are many, many people that aren't here today that have been very instrumental in this final product. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Dimbrough.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I really can't add much to what Representative Huffman just said. He has a lot of history on this subject and obviously went through some very contentious times over it. For me, I have to say that my experience has been very positive. I think if you look at this committee as a whole in addressing this issue, and certainly it's also true in the work group, you know, you really couldn't tell who was elected as a member of the good party and who was elected as a member of the other party. You know, it's that was a joke. I think we all were just really focused on fixing a problem and really improving conditions for all students at all schools throughout the state. And I thank you enormously, Madam Chair, for your leadership on this issue.
Thank you, Representative Springer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Not a lot. Lots of things have been said, and I would agree with probably all of them, except the good party, the other party part. But anyway, the focus, I think, was pretty clear in everybody's mind in there, and there were many people to remind us of that around the table. This bill is about protecting kids. It really boils down to being that simple. It's about protecting kids, not against people that aren't doing anything, but against people that are. And so I think we have achieved that goal.
We have. And I think the product of this work, and certainly this comes out of a body of work that Senator Walker has been addressing for many biennia, with the passage of this bill, bar none, Oregon will have the strongest laws protecting the safety of children in schools of any state in the nation. And I think that's something that we can be proud of and that all of our partners can be proud of for helping to make that happen.
Not 49. We're finally number one.
That's right. We are number one.
We're the happy cat.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. If I could just briefly mention, I had hoped, don't everybody get excited here, I had hoped to be able to introduce an amendment, but I don't have the fiscal back yet. The only concern I had about this bill, and I think it's a big one, but I think it's very a minor fix, so as this potentially moves out, I just urge the Senate to look at this. The only concern I had is on page 2, line 13, sexual conduct means any verbal or physical conduct. I was concerned that electronic and written was not there, and I know the legislature right now is dealing with an issue of a bill that was passed and became law in 07, and now they're adding texting. And so I don't think that was anybody's intent for that to not be there, and maybe I'm just kind of getting down into the weeds. But I don't have a fiscal. I won't be introducing that. I do think that's an important piece that we need to look at and keep mindful of.
And I will share that with Senator Hatch so that when this gets over to the Senate side next week, they can have the opportunity to address that issue. Representative Roland.
I just had a question. You know, I've heard the comment that one of the requirements from the receiving district is the previous 3 employers. And I can't find exactly where that's at in here, and I don't know why I missed it. But I just want to make sure that it doesn't say you have to have 3. Because it says you have to have 3 and you've only worked at 1, it's really difficult to do it. And we have written stuff in the past that gives us the indication that you have to have 3, and I just don't know how to solve that problem for the person that's only had 1. So I want to read the language to make sure that it didn't require 3 when you haven't had 3.
Section 7.
Are we okay?
Yes, we're okay. It actually does not have...
Thank you. I just didn't want to have some dingy thing come back and say to me that, you know, I can't comply with the new rules because I've only worked in one place.
Thank you.
There's no doubt it would.
Good question. Yes.
Section
7. Representative Van Orman.
I'm curious about the use of sexual conduct as opposed to sexual misconduct.
I believe that the idea was that any sexual conduct with a child is misconduct.
That's what was said.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
And Madam Chair, let me just say that a lot of that definition was based on information that we got from teacher standard practices, which has been very helpful.
Okay.
Which also talks about email communications, I think, as an example of inappropriate sexual conduct.
Okay, thank you.
I think let's get a motion on the table as we're doing this. We can discuss more as we get the motion on the table.
Madam Chair, I move to adopt the Dash 8 amendments dated 3609.
Thank you. Representative Springer moves to adopt the Dash 8 amendment stated 3609. And next in the queue, we have Representative Comp.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On page 9, section 8, subsection 2, according to, I was trying to listen very carefully as you gave the overview, and it's a question about, it says that an education provider may disclose the information on a standardized form and is not required. Just could you explain this language a little one more time? Because, and if there is a standardized form, will it be used, won't it be used, may it or may not?
Thank you, Representative Comp. The form is the way that the information will be communicated, so that it's very clear what the information is. The only information that may be shared is the date of the substantiation and the number of substantiated allegations that there are.
Okay. It's just real hard for me to discern that out of that statement, but I'll trust you.
Thank you.
Well, that's elsewhere in the language, if I may.
Yes, is it then? Yes, here it's on page 8. It's in 7 sub 2. And by conduct a review of the employment history of the applicant by contacting the three most recent employers of the applicant who are education providers and requesting the following information: the dates of employment of the applicant by the education provider, whether the applicant was the subject of any substantiated reports of child abuse or sexual conduct related to the applicant's employment with the education provider, the dates of any substantiated reports, the definitions of child abuse and sexual conduct used by the education provider when the education provider determined that any reports were substantiated, and the standards used by the education provider to determine whether any reports were substantiated.
Thank you. I was just scanning and hadn't found it yet.
So, Representative Roblin.
So I read that together,
mm-hmm.
and it says they shall under Section 7. So they have to do these things.
Yes.
And one thing they have to do is contact the last three employers.
Correct.
I only had one. They can't contact my other two. Do I have a problem? I don't have a problem. Okay.
I think that's standard language.
No. Okay.
Thank you. Representative Harker was trying to get into the queue.
True enough. Thank you, Madam Chair. There, we have these fiscal reports, but they're all indeterminate.
Correct.
Undecided. Do we have... Is that going to stop us from moving this?
No, we are ready to move this bill and one other when we're done answering questions.
Are we comfortable with that?
Yes, we are comfortable with that. That happens. We have indeterminate fiscals. This is information that we cannot have concrete anticipation of the number of reports that will be filed or the number of forms that will be printed.
Okay. All right.
Representative Van Orman.
Well, then I'm assuming that by what you said, the Department of Education does do the form. Is that it, or is each school district responsible?
The form, what we have prescribed in rule here, is what is on the form. There
right.
can be no other information disclosed on the form, and this is the information that must be on the form. So we have basically described the form.
No, my question is, who's paying for it? So my presumption is, based on the fact that we want a standardized form, that it comes out of the Department of Education.
Let's stand at ease for a moment, please. Thank you.
I would expect that the...
is likely to create the form. Where the form comes from is not mandated in the bill. OSBA says that they are likely to do it. What's important is that the information is what we have statutorily required. And are there any further comments before we move to a vote on this bill? Representative Comp.
And thank you for your indulgence and my true appreciation for all the work of the subgroup. But again, it goes back to, we keep continuing, and I'm not going to beat this up forever, but the rulemaking process is very important in this process, that it is done within the intent of what our debate and discussion has been.
Absolutely. Any further comments before we move to a vote on this bill? Representative Nimbro.
I'd like to move the amendment.
Oh, we already did.
Did we do that?
Yes.
The dash eight.
Are there any objections to the so Representative Springer previously moved the dash eight amendments to the bill? Are there any objections to the dash eight amendments? No, seeing none, so ordered.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2062 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Springer moves House Bill 2062 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any further discussion? Seeing none, Debbie, would you please call the roll?
Representative Harper?
Aye.
Representative Hussman?
Aye.
Representative Cox?
Aye.
Representative Maurer?
Aye.
Representative Roland?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Representative Van Orman?
Aye.
Vice Chair Dimbro?
Aye.
Vice Chair Springer?
Aye.
And Chair Gilzer?
Chair votes aye. Having received the required votes, House Bill 2062 as amended is passed to the floor, and I will carry the bill, and I am closing the work session on House Bill 2062. Thank you to all of the people that have worked extraordinarily hard on this. And I'm now opening a work session on House Bill 2063. House Bill 2063 is a companion bill to House Bill 2062. Kevin, can you briefly tell us about House Bill 2063?
This was previously before the Education Committee. The matter or the bill requires employees of the Teachers Standards and Practice Commission to report child abuse, and also there is a dash one amendment that accompanies it that limits the reporting responsibility to teachers of the TSPC directly involved in investigations or disciplined by the commission, and that is the dash one amendment as well.
Thank you very much. Representative Dimbro.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would like to move that we adopt the dash one amendment to House Bill 2063 dated January 29th, 2009.
Representative Dimbro moves the dash one amendment to House Bill 2063. Is there any objection? Seeing none, so ordered. Representative Dimbro.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2063 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Dimbro moves House Bill 2063 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, Debbie, would you please call the roll?
Representative Harper?
Aye.
Representative Hussman?
Aye.
Representative Comp?
Aye.
Representative Maurer?
Aye.
Representative Roland?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Representative Van Orman?
Aye.
Vice Chair Dimbro?
Aye.
Vice Chair Springer?
Aye.
Chair Gilzer?
Aye. Having received the required votes, the motion passes. Representative Springer, will you carry this bill?
Absolutely.
Thank you. The work session on House Bill 2063 is closed. Colleagues, thank you for working right up to the end of the hour. I know that we've had very full agendas recently. Next week we may get a brief reprieve after bullying, which we take up on Monday.
Exactly.
We take tomorrow off.
You may have tomorrow off. No committee tomorrow. Colleagues, thank you very much. Have a wonderful weekend, and the House Committee on Education.
Onward to health care.
Good show.
Good.
You too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I ran out.